Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. This is Sherry Quinn.
When we came under your command, Colonel, you stated very clearly that we would never find Negroes who could pass a pilot's exam, make it through flight school, survive basic combat. We've done all of that.
I don't believe your boys have scored a single aerial kill.
It's damn hard to shoot down the enemy 100 miles behind the front lines.
What we do, how well we do it, does it matter?
And you all thought what?
You'd sign up, and that'd be the end of 100 years of bigotry. Get your head up, son. You fighter pilots.
We have a right to fight for our country, the same as every other American. We will not go away.
I can't afford the kind of losses my bombers have been suffering. Can you help save lives?
If you get us new planes, we can help your boys.
Nothing's difficult.
Everything's a challenge.
Through adversity to the stars.
From the last plane to the last bullet to the last minute to the last man, we fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
We fight.
That is a clip from the film Red Tails, currently showing in movie theaters. It is based on the story of the Tuskegee Airmen, the first African-American fighter pilots who fought in World War II. Thursday morning, the Hill Air Force Base African Heritage Committee celebrated their contribution to the war with a speech by a very special guest, retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel James Harvey III, the first African-American pilot to fly combat missions over Korean airspace.
Welcome to the Team Hills 2012 Tuskegee Airmen Commemoration Speech. I am Staff Sergeant Tchaikovsky Crosley from the 75th Security Forces Squadron. I would like to acknowledge some special guests that we have in our presence. Our guest speaker, Tuskegee Airman, Lieutenant Colonel James Harvey. Today we are here to reflect on the life and many accomplishments of a special group of Americans, and in particular, Lieutenant Colonel James Harvey. Those heroes who fought gallantly during World War II saved countless lives, and their efforts definitely impacted the outcome of the war. Before the American military was racially segregated, their accomplishments were not immediately recognized by our armed forces. However, their stories were carried forward by the men whose lives they saved. They were known as Tuskegee Airmen and were originally signed to the 332nd Fighter Group, the 477th Bomberment Group of the U.S. Army Air Corps. They were the first African-American military aviators in the United States Armed Forces.
According to Colonel Harvey, the Tuskegee Airmen were highly educated college graduates who simply wanted to fight and fly for their country, despite the discrimination they endured in the U.S. military.
They were told they did not have the ability to fly aircraft or operate heavy machinery. They were inferior to the white man. They were nothing. Now, I've been told that I sound bitter. I'm not bitter. I just put out the facts. The Tuskegee Airmen, we were the best.
Here is part of retired Lieutenant Colonel James Harvey's speech.
How many of you have heard of the War College Report of 1936? Many officers in the Army, the majority of whom were from the South, believed in the stereotypes perpetuated by the Army War College studies of the Negro produced in the previous decade and the War College reports of 1936. The War College studies and reports were primarily unscientific surveys and interviews of white officers who commanded Negro troops in World War I. According to the studies, the Negro soldiers were childlike, careless, shiftless, irresponsible, secretive, superstitious, unmoral and untruthful, and more likely to be guilty of moral turpitude. The Negro soldier was also branded as a comic, emotionally unstable, musically inclined with good rhythm, and a fed, loyal, and complaint. Now, how would you like to have those adjectives hang over your head? But during that time, I'd say about 90% or 95% of your commanders in the Army were from the South. So this report just reinforced their thoughts about the Negro soldier or military person. Now, who were the Tuskegee Airmen? The Tuskegee Airmen were originally a group of highly educated college graduates who wanted to fly and fight for their country. But they were told they did not have the ability to fly aircraft or operate heavy machinery. They were inferior to the white man. They were nothing. Now, I've been told that I sound bitter. I'm not bitter. I just put out the facts. So you can accept the facts the way you want to. There was a lot of pressure from the Negro press, the NAACP, for the Army to get Negroes in and train them as pilots. And President Roosevelt was seeking a third term. So it was decided to establish the 99th Pursuit Squadron to be manned by the graduates from the Tuskegee Flying School. Well, they needed an airfield for us to get our basic and advanced training. So the War Department awarded a contract to a Negro architectural firm called McKissick and McKissick. And this was in January of 1941. And they were given this contract to design and build this airfield. And they gave them until September of 41 to complete this project. Now, that's not a very long time, is it? Okay. Now, pursuit flying is the most demanding flying there is. You have to master navigation, gunnery, and acrobatics. So, based on this and our flying training program that was designed for our failure, they knew that there wouldn't be anyone to graduate from the Tuskegee Flying School to man the 99th Pursuit Squadron. They knew without a doubt. Now, our training, like I said, was designed for our failure. It was different than the white cadets. Now, let's recap. The War College report degraded us. They put the flying school in Tuskegee, Alabama. In print, they say they put the flying school at Tuskegee, Alabama, because Tuskegee had the best Civil Aeronautics Association training program of any of the Negro colleges. Now, that doesn't compute, because they didn't want us to fly in the first place. The reason they put the flying school at Tuskegee, Alabama, during that period of time, Tuskegee, Alabama was the worst place in the country for Negroes. It was sport to go out on a Saturday night, pick up a young black, beat him, castrate him, hang him, or all the above, and then maybe torture him while he was hanging. Now, they surmised that the bulk of the cadets coming to Tuskegee for flying training would be coming from the north, see these conditions, and give up. Well, the way we overcame that, we stayed on the post, because if you don't subject yourself to that, nothing's going to happen. So the success of the Tuskegee Airmen can be summed up in the four hurrahs. We graduated from Tuskegee, and proved them wrong that we were the best. Number the second hurrah, the 332nd Fighter Group flew 200 bomber escort missions and established a record that would never be equaled. And the last hurrah, in January of 1949, Chief of Staff of the Air Force sent a directive out to all the fighter groups in the United States saying that they would have gunnery competition, intramural competition within each group. And based on their scores, they would pick three pilots, three primary pilots, and one alternate pilot to represent the group at the first ever United States Air Force weapons meet at Las Vegas Air Force Base, Nevada, which is now Nellis. Before we left Lockbourne, we, meaning the four pilots who participated in the gunnery meet, we met with Colonel Davis, our commander. We talked, and Colonel Davis' final remarks were, "If you don't win, don't come back." That was tongue-in-cheek, of course, but that's why we won. We won the meet, the 332nd Fighter Group. However, in print, we were not recognized as the winner. The Air Force Association puts out an almanac. One of the items in the almanac are the winners of the 1949 weapons meet through present day. Each year when the almanac came out, the winner of the 1949 weapons meet was listed as unknown, every year, unknown. Finally, in 1993, I think it was April, my commander, Colonel William Campbell, he was the commander of the 332nd Fighter Group, called me and said, do you have any records about the Air Force, about the weapons meet in 49? I says, no, I don't. Maybe Stuart does. He calls Stuart, and Stuart directed him to Nellis Air Force Base. He went to Nellis, and he found all the records. He presented them to the Air Force. As of April of 1995, it shows the 332nd Fighter Group as the winner of the 1949 weapons meet. 46 years. They knew we won, just didn't want to recognize it. Our trophy, it was lost. We have a lady in Atlanta. She's an historian. She's the president of the Atlanta chapter of the Tuskegee Airmen. She made it her mission to find this trophy. She found it in 5 days at the Wright-Patterson Air Force Base Museum storage area. She went to Wright-Patterson. She saw the trophy. She said, why isn't this on display? He said, we got a lot of items in. We can't display everything. This item will never be on display. Well, it is on display at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. 55 years in hiding. So, what can I say? End of story. Anyone have any questions?
The first question asked was about the movie Red Tails and whether or not it accurately portrayed the Tuskegee Airmen story.
It was very good, very good, very realistic. It was 22 years in the making. George Lucas had a hard time with that movie. He couldn't find anyone that would produce it. He couldn't find anyone to distribute it, so he used his own money. The comments that he received were, it's just another black movie. Well, it's not. It's history. But so far, the movie's going very, very, very well. So we're showing a lot of people, yes, there may not be any well-known movie stars in the movie, but it will sell itself. Now, 60% of the profits of movies are from the overseas market, and I'm quite sure it will do well overseas.
My question to you is, having experienced true racism, do you have any reaction now to some of the people who play the race card for what would be, relative to your experience, extremely inconsequential items?
Well, the way I see it, yes, it's sorry that this is still happening today. But then again, we as a race of people don't have a problem. They have the problem. We just do what we have to do to get to where we want to get.
Colonel Harvey, I have a question.
Yes, sir.
How old are you?
Well, I was born in 23. That's 0023. No, I'm 88.
88.
88, yes.
My question is, what was your call sign and how did you get it?
Well, we were in a different Air Force. There were two Air Forces. There was the Negro Air Force and there was the White Air Force. We didn't have call signs. We just had the number on our aircraft. That was it. I'm not bitter. I just put out the facts. The Tuskegee Airmen, we were the best.
That was retired Lieutenant Colonel James Harvey, one of the Tuskegee Airmen and the first African-American pilot to fly combat missions over Korean airspace. Sherry Quinn, Access Utah. Stay tuned for Science Questions up next.
Thanks for listening to Access Utah. It's a Friday. We're enjoying some great science reporting, Science Questions, wonderful programs coming up. I'm Tom Williams with Shalane Smith Needham. Just a couple of minutes here to remind you that we're doing a special short pledge drive. And we're focusing on chocolate, so that's a good thing.
I always love that. Love chocolate.
And this is an opportunity for you to help your public radio station with an additional gift or become a new member. That's especially what we're targeting. And we'd love for you to call 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or go to our website, upr.org, upr.org. For $60 additional gift to Utah Public Radio or new membership, you can receive a box of these wonderful chocolates or have them sent to your loved one, wherever it may be. And we've had these boxes going to New York and other places around
right,
the country.
All over the country. So if you call in with your pledge of support of $60 or more, you can receive a box of these beautiful chocolates. They're so gorgeous, I almost hate to eat them, but that's not going to stop me for sure. So, and you can also have a personal message sent with them. So it's a great opportunity. We do have some people who have called in and have taken advantage of this opportunity. We have a caller from Salt Lake City who went online and contributed that way. We also have a caller from Logan. And then we'd like to thank Trilby Fry of Cedar City for calling in, and also Joan Shefke of North Logan. So thank you so much for your support.
We appreciate that. And, of course, this benefits Utah Public Radio. We've never done this before. Other stations have.
Right.
Around Valentine's Day, and we decided to do it before Valentine's Day so you could prepare, and this will help you to get that gift out.
Oh,
to
it's a great, unique gift. And I also think if you want to get one for yourself, why not? And also support the station at the same time.
That'd be wonderful. And so for this is just $60 basically per box. $60 contribution to Utah Public Radio gets you a box for yourself or a loved one. 122 boxes, 183 boxes. That's just the way it goes. And these will be, you don't have to send these out. These will be sent out to your loved one
or
come directly to you, whatever you would like. So the number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or upr.org, upr.org. The money comes to support great programming like Sherry Quinn's Access Utah and Science Questions.
Yes, and the last couple of programs that she's featured have been from Sundance, so we've done some Sundance coverage this year. So we always look forward to that, and her program's great. We do get a lot of great comments on it. So it's a wonderful opportunity for you to show your support for Access Utah and for Science Questions by calling 1-800-826-1495 or go online, upr.org.
And we realize that you likely are already a member of Utah Public Radio. Thank you so much. We very much appreciate that. Couldn't do it without you. Here's a chance for just an additional gift to Utah Public Radio and at the same time take care of your Valentine's shopping. So this is a very efficient way to do that. $60 to get that wonderful box of chocolates. Should mention the company. It's a wonderful company in Utah, in Ogden, at Chocolat Artisan Confections. These are handmade artisan chocolates. They've been featured a lot of places and are famous in their own right, and we're very happy to be partnering with them.
It's worth it to go online. If you go online to upr.org, you can see a picture of these chocolates, and they are beautiful. So I think that would be a great incentive. Go take a look at them, and keep in mind that when you contribute $60 or more, you can receive a box of chocolates. I believe there are 12 inside. Mm.
And what a wonderful way to become a new member of Utah Public Radio. Once again, the number is 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, for the love of Utah Public Radio. And for the love of your Valentine, upr.org. That's upr.org.
Support for Science Questions comes from USU's College of Science, advancing the educational experience of future scientists with advanced research in the lab, field, and outer space. When students and faculty learn together, discovery follows. Information is at usu.edu/science.
Welcome to Science Questions. I am Sherry Quinn.
And I am Susie Montgomery. In part 4 of our series on the field of epigenetics, we interviewed one of the leading scientists and advocates in the field. also the chair at the Keystone Conference of Epigenomics and Human Disease Susceptibility in Asheville, North Carolina.
Moshe Schiff, Professor of Pharmacology at McGill University.
Epigenetics is the study of heritable changes in gene expression or cellular phenotype caused by mechanisms other than changes in the underlying DNA sequence. Hence the name epi, meaning over, above, and outer. In the last 37 years, Canadian Moshe Schiff has made some shocking discoveries. His research done at a suicide brain bank in Quebec gives us a whole new perspective on suicide, confirming social policy goes hand in hand with biology. And he even ponders the epigenetic consequences of social media and suggests sites like Facebook could change the architecture of our brains, the way we look, behave, and think.
We're changing the environment. We're changing the social environment. There's no question. What is going to be the impact on humans is still unclear, but it's definitely a fascinating research question.
In keeping with the trend of almost all the leading epigeneticists in this SQ Radio series, Moshe Schiff arrived to the field of epigenetics on a very indirect route. And like many others too, he came from a background prioritizing ethics and philosophy.
I actually started my university career in philosophy and political sciences. And then family pressures moved me to dental school. And upon completion of dental school, I had to do a thesis. So I was then at the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. And Aaron Razin, who was just pioneering the field of DNA methylation, he just discovered the methyl group on Phi-X-174, which was the first model system to study DNA methylation. And we had no idea, you know, how far it will go. It was just a bacteriophage. And I met him, and he agreed to supervise me. And then I started doing it, and I fell in love with it, with DNA methylation, and that was 37 years ago.
According to experts in the field, Moshe Schiff's work has led to a paradigm shift with regards to the influence of the social and physical environment on the human genome. His research shows that DNA methylation, an epigenetic modification that changes the appearance and structure of DNA without altering its sequence, can actually change after the gestation period. And he bucks the theory that it was ever fixed.
We have been working for 20 years, we means the field, on understanding how DNA methylation is involved in cellular differentiation and explaining how, you know, one genome can have multiple phenotypes in a human or in an animal that is a multicellular organism. But we always thought that once an organism is completed at birth, that's it. The methylation pattern doesn't change. We also thought that DNA methylation pattern is similar amongst individuals. So nobody looked into DNA methylation as a source of inter-individual variation. And the idea was that DNA methylation is fixed, and if it's fixed, it's impossible for it to be responsive to the environment, except maybe during gestation. And But I never bought this idea that DNA methylation is fixed. There's no reaction in biology that is fixed. They're all reversible at some point. And we worked first in cancer, where we saw rampant changes in DNA methylation and in the enzymes that regulate methylation, and especially enzymes that remove DNA methylation. So that gave us a first idea that DNA methylation can change between individuals, it can cause cancer, and that it is dynamically regulated. And at some point, I think in the early 90s, I met Michael Meany, who was working on maternal care. And so I was already developing these ideas of a dynamic DNA methylation, but in cancer. And he told me about this amazing phenomena that differences in maternal care will result in different phenotypes in the offspring, which is something I never thought about. And even though he had strong evidence that it's not genetic, because he could cross-foster the mothers, and it wasn't the biological mother, but it was the fostering mother that defined the phenotype of the pup. And that suggested that there is something going on that memorizes that maternal experience. And working on DNA methylation, I thought that perhaps the mother's attachment is altering the DNA methylation pattern in the offspring. And that's how later in life, they exhibit different phenotypes. So we started studying it, and we have been providing evidence that that's true. But that was the first indication that the environment, in this case, an amazing social environment, and that was even more radical. I mean, we could understand that some poisons could, you know, change DNA methylation, but that the social environment could change DNA methylation was something we didn't think about. But that was exactly fitting with where I was with the cancer and in looking at a dynamic DNA methylation pattern.
You can say that, or you say that cancer is an epigenetic disease.
Cancer is an epigenetic disease and could be treated by epigenetic drugs. And I would say that perhaps a large fraction of human disease is epigenetic.
What has been overall response to that?
So even for cancer, you know, when I presented my first abstract in a DNA methylation meeting, they refused to publish it in the abstract book because they said it's, one of the reviewers said it was a misguided attempt at scientific humor. And there was a tremendous rejection of the idea that DNA methylation participates in anything except cellular differentiation. And if it participates in cellular differentiation, the feeling was it has to be strong, it has to be fixed, because otherwise we will constantly change, you know, our differentiation, which is something that can't happen. But the cancer story became more and more accepted, and now, as we know, a lot of drug companies are developing drugs against DNA methylation enzymes, and DNA methylation diagnostics is big in cancer, so I think that discussion is over. But now a new discussion started, whether the environment can actually change DNA methylation after birth and throughout life. And I think that jury is not out yet. There is a lot of resistance to accept that, especially from hardcore molecular biologists.
This radical idea that DNA methylation can change due to environmental conditions and that our experiences can influence our phenotype, malleable long after we are born, is hard for many of us to swallow.
I don't know why it is that, but I think it has to do with dogmas, right? So, you know, if we felt for so many years that DNA methylation does not change after birth, that all the changes in DNA methylation happen during, you know, early differentiation, early development, then we feel uncomfortable that such a mechanism that is so critical for differentiating cells will be dynamic as well. You know, it seems like a contradiction. And that's one thing. I think the other thing is that the effects that one sees in the brain are not as large as the effects that one sees in a cancer. And the difference is very clear. A cancer is a clonal population. So every cell is similar to the other cell. So once you have a change in methylation and that cell replicates, all the cells will have the same change. So the changes in cancer are 100 to 0. Whereas in the brain, one or few neurons change because you experience something. The changes in methylation will be in the few percent range. And even these are big changes. Probably most of the changes are in the point something percent range. So that's another problem. When you move from, you know, very strong methylation changes, like in differentiation, where the entire system changes its methylation, to cancer, where again, all the cells, or most of the cells, go the same way, to what happens in the brain, it's hard to accept.
Through the course of Mosheshev's career, he has developed what he calls a brain bank to study the physical effects of adversity on our brains. Through brain scanning, he is finding clear evidence that indeed, victimization as a child leaves its mark.
The first study we did was with rats. As interesting as rats are, we're interested to know, is it true for humans? You know, do humans have the same things? And with humans, it's very hard to study questions like this because we can't do experiments with humans. And we definitely don't have access to brains in humans except after they die. And so we took advantage of an amazing resource, which is the Quebec Brain Bank that was founded by a colleague of mine, Dr. Gustavo Turecki. And essentially what's interesting about that brain bank is that every victim of suicide in Quebec whose brain comes to this bank and the control groups are very well phenotyped. So we can now go backwards and say whether this as a human being was abused as a child or not abused as a child and other issues. So we wanted to see whether differences in paternal or maternal care would be reflected in methylation patterns in adulthood. So we took brains of adults who were either victimized as children or went through normal childhood, We had two groups of people who committed suicide, because that was the original goal of this brain bank, to study suicide, and we had a control group. We were very careful that they would be the same age, they were all males, to avoid gender issues, and we looked at the same areas where we looked in the rats, and we found a similar change in methylation in brains of people who were abused as children. And that was different from people who either committed suicide or not, who were not abused as children. So these marks seem to be associating with childhood abuse. And what's remarkable about it is that we're looking at 35 years old, and we can see those marks in the brain.
These marks then are developed during their childhood.
That's our guess. Of course, we can't study that, because to study it properly, you have to sample them throughout their life, which is impossible to do in the brain, and therefore we're trying to do it in blood. So our current studies are trying to ask the question whether similar marks will be found in the immune system, which is much more accessible to epidemiological studies. So we went to first to study monkeys, where we could have sampled brain and blood at the same time. And we looked at the similar question. We looked at monkeys who were essentially deprived of maternal care because they were removed from their mothers when they were young, and control groups. And that's the fantastic world of another colleague of mine, Stephen Suomi, who has been interested in the effects of maternal and maternal attachment on the phenotype. And again, in monkeys, like in rats, like in humans, the mother has a tremendous impact on the phenotype of the offspring. And so we compare the methylation pattern here in the brain and in blood. And now we're finalizing the study, and we're seeing similar results, where many, many regions in the DNA, in the genome, are differentially methylated based on whether the monkey had a mother or not when he was young.
Rather than studying behavioral disorders, Mosheshev is focusing on the environments that produce different behaviors.
We have a study that we just completed looking at people from different socioeconomic positioning and looking at adversity or economic adversity early in life and economic adversity later in life. So we have four groups: those who are adverse early in life but rich later in life, and vice versa, and those who maintain adversity throughout life, and those who maintained relaxed conditions throughout life. And we compare their methylation pattern, but this time in the blood, because these people are alive. And again, here we took advantage of a longitudinal study that has been gone for more than 50 years. It's the British Birth Cohort of 1958. And so these people are 50 years old, but we have good records of their history. And we compare their DNA methylation pattern, and that was done in collaboration with University College of London and University of British Columbia, with Clyde Hertzman and Marcus Pembry and Chris Power. And we could distinguish in the blood signatures of DNA methylation that seemed to associate with adversity in childhood, irrespective of what happened to these people later on in life.
And how was that manifesting in these people?
It was manifested in changes in DNA methylation, right? So the people we looked at were healthy people, but they came from extreme differences in socioeconomic positioning. But the epidemiological data suggests that people who suffered adversity in life will have a whole gamut of health problems later in life, from mental health down to physical health, whether it's obesity, diabetes, and mental problems, etc. But we specifically did not focus on sick people. We focused on people who otherwise look healthy.
Okay.
Of course, the next interesting question will be, how could these predict who will be at risk to suffer from cardiovascular, diabetes, mental health problems later in life? And of course, that's the greatest challenge.
Thing right now.
So our guess is that we will be able to identify DNA methylation marks early in life that could predict susceptibility to disease later in life. And that could change the way we intervene, for example, rather than intervening with the entire population, which is expensive. If we can do prevention early in life, we can probably eradicate those differences if we identify those people who are at risk. But the nature of things is that even people who come from very low socioeconomic positioning with very high adversity, many of them are resilient and they will do extremely well. So we don't want to waste time on these people. The challenge is to identify those people at risk. So the nature of DNA methylation is that it is potentially reversible. As we talked before, it is dynamic. And dynamic means it can get on and get off. So on one hand, it's very stable. On the other hand, it is potentially reversible.
And to reverse DNA methylation, drugs might be the answer. Mosheshev founded the first company dedicated to epigenetics called Methylgene, located in Montreal, Canada, and the concept has picked up where many epigenetic drug companies are popping up all over the world.
And it could be reversed potentially by either very strong behavioral interventions, like strong diets, strong cognitive interventions, or by drugs, the same drugs that we use for cancer. And actually, some of the drugs that were used in cancer are now being tried in mental health, for example, with this idea that we can reverse deleterious DNA methylation signals.
So this could have huge implications then, too, for mental disorders.
Yes. Absolutely. There is no difference in the basis of it between mental and physical problems. They all involve, the way we look at it, problems in gene expression. And these are regulated by DNA methylation and other epigenetic factors. So there's no reason why a drug that can work on cancer should not work on a mental health situation if the basic molecular problem is very similar.
But how far off is that from being determined?
We're very far and we're very near. So what we have now are drugs that are not very clean. But I know that they are being tested. So, and a good example is one drug that has been used for decades in mental health, which is called valproic acid, which we know is an epigenetic drug. We didn't know that in the past, but now we know it is an epigenetic drug. So there is a drug that is working and is being used that is an epigenetic drug. And I know about clinical trials that are taking, for example, what we call HDAC inhibitors, which are epigenetic drugs, in certain conditions in mental health. There are animal studies that suggest that some of these drugs can promote memory.
Now Mosheshev is leading studies looking at human aggression through the lens of epigenetics. Scientists have not found a violence gene, nor do they expect to discover one. Instead, Mosheshev and team are attempting to tease out the complex interactions among genetics, environmental influences, and violence and aggression. The idea is that certain genetic traits, when combined with life experiences, can help propel a person towards a life of crime. Still, much remains unknown. If Mosheshev and his team are right, their work could lead to the development of biologically targeted social programs or the administration of drugs to counter the genes in a toxic environment.
If somebody is aggressive, is it because of some free will or is it because his DNA is marked? And can we use it in court? Can we use it as an argument to defend somebody that it wasn't his responsibility, it was his DNA, either that was mutated by genetics or was marked by epigenetics, and it's his mother's responsibility? I mean, these are complex issues. What does DNA methylation imply as far as human responsibility? Both responsibility of the environment, the social environment, when somebody abuses an employee or a soldier or a student or a child, might have long-term consequences beyond the abuse itself that can change the behavior of the abused, and then that behavior could be criminal. So who is responsible for that criminality? And I know that a lot of law experts are interested in those questions because they do have legal manifestation. And that shows you the wide appeal of epigenetics. I think people are interested in epigenetics come now from political sciences, from history, from social sciences. For example, historical forces are forces that are driving probably epigenetic powers, changing environments, moving, attacking a country and creating aggression in a country. Aggression is connected to maternal care. And so we know this from animal studies and human studies. So whether it's shooting or other forms of aggression, there is strong data that associates adolescent aggression with maternal care. And I'm just collaborating with a colleague in Montreal, Richard Tremblay, who is looking at that aggression. And actually, the best predictor of aggression was maternal education. And maternal education is a proxy for essentially maternal care and attention. And he has done a few interventions that actually helped. And one of the interventions he did was a very rich daycare environment that kind of substituted for the mother or for maternal education. Okay. But an educated mother will read more to their children, will, you know, overall pay more attention to the children, and it's kind of a surrogate marker of maternal care, really. So there's multiple questions from all fields of human scholarship and activity that have an epigenetic basis for.
Through Simply Living, it is widely accepted that child abuse offenders were often abused themselves. Mosheshev is proving, scientifically demonstrating, physical scarring in the brain tissue is an artifact of abuse. It will be interesting to see if our history is showing up in this biological evidence of epigenetic markers. Will this lead to social reform? Mosheshev leans towards yes and exudes a refreshing optimism for politicians.
Policy-making people depends on their education and intelligence. Some of them are getting interested. It doesn't mean it had an impact yet. I mean, to be honest, a lot of this stuff was known. I mean, we knew that poverty isn't good. We knew that abuse isn't good. But I think what epigenetics is giving hard molecular marks for that and hard evidence in science. So it's not anymore the magic of somehow abuse causes bad behavior later in life. But there is a chemical process that that leads from abuse to changes in behavior or to changes in health. That has policy implications. And I think sooner or later, they will pick it up. And I was approached by the ex-prime minister of Canada, who was interested in the Aboriginals in Canada. And one of the things that happened to Aboriginals in Canada was that they were moved to residential schools. They were moved essentially from their parents into residential school, exactly like those monkeys and those rats. And so here you have a population that was victimized by very early in life that is exactly the model that we are studying. And what's interesting about that population, have a very high suicide risk, one of the highest in the world. It's very hard to establish at this stage that it's the removal of kids from their home to residential school that caused it, but it's plausible. And policymakers are looking at that and saying, wait a minute, there might be a mechanism that can explain it. But what's interesting about the Aboriginals is that these changes happened three generations ago. And so we see now effects of the third generation whose grandmother or grandfather were removed from their homes when they were little kids. And so now the question is, the big question is, are there markers that show up or not? We haven't looked at it. But this idea came not from me, it came from a politician, which means they understand what we're doing and they're applying it and they're asking the right questions.
Okay. Mosheshev depicts certain areas where he foresees epigenetics informing social programs and catalyzing intervention.
So one of the things we learn from animals is that good intervention can substitute for a mother. And so, you know, one policy implication could be having high-quality childcare. It costs a lot of money, but economists are now calculating how much money that would save later on. And, you know, jail time and criminality and the health. The Europeans are much more sensitive to these issues. And I think we are going in a transition between the genetic age where essentially we thought whatever genes you have will throw you anywhere and you will do well. You know, you can have a parent, no parent, it won't make any difference because your genes are good. And there's some people who think this way. But I think once we shift away from this and we realize that the genes need to interact and be sculpted by the environment, and we'll start paying attention to the environment and we'll start doing the calculations, both the social, political, and economic calculations, that some investments are worth it because in the end they're going to save us money. Epigenetics and economics are going to be very interesting partners in the next decade or so.
Word is getting out and proliferating into mainstream media as scientists and policymakers are internalizing the shocking and rather satisfying implications of epigenetics. Its arms extend into infinite disciplines, inevitably drawing attention to the likely enormous impact of toxic environments on human behavior. Research at the Keystone Conference in North Carolina cemented the role of epigenetics in disease and human behavior.
The fantastic thing about this meeting, comparing to, you know, let's say 2 years earlier or 5 years earlier, you saw how much work is coming up. And once you spread these things, you don't need to do it yourself. The whole world is doing it. So I think we are going to generate a huge amount of data on the relationships between environments and human health and behavior. We've seen different kinds of studies that will provide the knowledge from different kind of corners of this question. I think epigenetics will eventually become a very powerful diagnostic tool, predictive tool. Probably no physician will work without getting epigenetic data before and after and throughout. I think prevention will use a lot of epigenetic data and epigenetic mechanism to kind of conceive about prevention strategies, both at a population level and at the individual level. Epigenetics might change the way we do preventions. It might focus it on the right populations. And it might have an impact on our thinking, on our philosophy, on questions of responsibility, or questions of, you know, what is the significance of a family? What is the significance of a mother? You know, what is the significance of a society? What is the significance of the workplace? And we were very concerned for, you know, a century about poisons, lead, PCB, and there's a lot of work on these, of course, are epigenetic modifiers. But what I'm trying to emphasize is that it's not just lead or PCB. Perhaps there are many more toxic environments which are social environments. Mm-hmm. And I think by having hard markers, we will pay more respect to the social environments. I mean, social evolution evolved certain behaviors that we completely got rid of in a century, right? We had a reason why we had a family. Obviously, it worked. And probably we tried different things during evolution till that form worked. And we recognized that it worked. And those who came from a family probably had an advantage. And that's why family survived. And now, in our century, because we were so smart, we thought that just by ideology, we can get away with social evolution. We can just do whatever we think is right. And we paid very little respect to biology. And a lot of the social scientists and social activists, you know, a lot of social activism had paid no respect to biology. Like asking the question, what is the biological implication lack of maternal care, of single parenthood, of, you know, a lot of things that we're doing because they're cool. But we never ask the question, what is the biological implication? I don't think you can have social policy without biology. We're changing the environment. We're changing the social environment. There's no question. What is going to be the impact on humans is still unclear, but it's definitely a fascinating research question. You know, is a social media environment similar to just hanging out with friends in a bar? And what kind of impact it will have on our health and behavior? I don't know, but I'm sure people are going to look into it. Yeah. The epigenetic consequences of social media. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to part 4, The Biology of Aggression, in our series Epigenetics 101. Science Questions is produced by Sherry Quinn and Susie Montgomery.
Access Utah is a production of Utah Public Radio. You can listen to this episode or previous episodes of Access Utah anytime at upr.org, where you can find a link to subscribe to our podcast. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1, 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1, 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1, 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1, 88.7 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1, 91.5 Logan.
Support for Utah Public Radio comes from S.E. Needham Jewelers in historic downtown Logan since 1896, specializing in diamond engagement rings and custom jewelry design, middle of the block at the sign of the clock. Information at seneedham.com.